From the Scripps Institution in California, this is Dr. Jeremy Jackson in March of 2006 with his presentation, Brave New Ocean. Find it at their website with the full video. Here's a quick MP3 for your iPod.
I was very moved by David Wake's talk yesterday and hearing the sort of the passion and the triste talking about these animals that he's worked on all his life and how beautiful they are. And all I can say is that the talk I'm going to give is David Wake's talk multiplied times 10 or 20 or 50, because instead of being one group of organisms, which is the canary in the coal mine, I'm going to be talking about virtually all the important predators in the ocean and virtually all the important habitat structure forming organisms in the ocean. And the news for virtually all of those groups is just about as good as it is for amphibians in the tropics. I really like this picture. I was at an event we did in the Shifting Baselines media campaign called Hollywood Ocean Night, and we had all these, you know, these Ben Stiller type people and everything there. And I was giving a talk and I was trying to figure out how do you relate to movie stars. And so I said, well, try to imagine you're in a movie called Escape from Malibu. And the reason for that is that it's become so dangerous to live there that the only people in Malibu are street people who can't afford to move to South Dakota, which is the new Malibu because it's really safe and whatever. And afterwards, my buddy Randy Olson said to me, Jeremy, you've really gone off the deep end this time, you know? You ought to be careful. Well, this is the Gold Coast of Florida. It's not California. That toxic algal bloom that's coming ashore causes massive respiratory failure and emergencies in the people who live in their retirement homes along the coast. That's today. It's an increasingly frequent event. It's an example of the rise of slime imposing itself on the life of people today, and that is the bellwether of the future of the oceans. About 6 years ago, we published a paper called Historical Overfishing and the Recent Collapse of Coastal Ecosystems that sort of made a stir, and what it was an attempt to come to grips with what was obviously going on in the oceans, in spite of the fact that we didn't have a lot of very good data. And so, for example, the paper starts off with these imaginary cartoon food webs. This is the way the ocean used to be on the left, and that's the way it is on the right for coral reefs. And you know, it's sort of obvious that the sharks ate those things and all the rest of it, but there weren't really any data. And then the most important point, really, of the paper was that as people have expanded in their activities and taken over the world, they started out exploiting, and all these different kinds of processes have kicked in the history of civilization at different times from then to now, but they were all still important. And if you could wave your magic wand and make climate change go away tomorrow, coral reefs, for example, would disappear in 10 or 20 years because of overfishing and pollution, and that you just have to think this way. Well, this paper really, really made a lot of people mad. And the reasons were sort of threefold. The ecologists hated it because it was obviously sloppy and unrigorous and didn't consist of replicated quarter square meter experiments in randomized block designs. The biological oceanographers hated it because the whole world knows that the world is controlled by bottom-up processes, meaning nutrients and variability in the environment. And of course, if you read their textbooks, you know that an apex predator is a copepod or occasionally a sardine. They were ahead of their time. And the fisheries biologists hated it because we demonstrated that the emperor had no clothes and their entire industry had been a scam for the last 50 years that had perpetuated the greatest ripoff of natural resources promulgated by scientists that the world has ever seen. But, you know, we sort of won. The NRC did a study and we got the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. saying that, you know, Rand Myers and Daniel Pauly and, oh, that guy Jackson, you know, they were right. Okay, so what I'm going to do in this talk is I'm basically going to follow up. What have we learned in the last 5 or 6 years? Because largely from the work of an extraordinary bunch of students of Daniel's and Rand's and mine and other people, I think we've put a lot of data and detail in the story. And I guess what's really upsetting to me is I didn't know how bad it was. I'm going to ask three questions. They're the same three questions that Rachel Carson asked in Silent Spring. What's going on that's new, different, and scary? What will happen if we don't stop doing those new, different, and scary things? And how could we, ha, 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 actually make it be better? There's six things going on in the oceans that are really bad. We're overfishing out everything bigger than of something like that. We're turning the seafloor into a parking lot. It's so flat. We're mixing species up, like we heard in the last talk. We're warming the ocean and turning it into a Coca-Cola ocean because of the rise of CO2. We're making a toxic soup, and what I'm really interested in is what I call the rise of slime, which is what eutrophication is. You have to admit it should have been the name of a rock group. So we're just going to go on a tour of different environments in the oceans. This is going to be lots of pictures and depressing graphs. Cod fishing in the northwestern Atlantic, the second most valuable natural commodity in the 17th, 18th century. World wars were fought over cod, and that's what it used to look like in that barren landscape of Newfoundland. And there used to be a whole lot of cod. This has been estimated in different kinds of ways. Biomass in terms of thousands of metric tons. Down on the right is where it was when the Canadian government in his wisdom said that cod stocks are really good. They opened up the fishery again. It crashed. 35,000 people lost their jobs. And it hasn't come back. And it was everywhere. This is Ram Myers' amazing data with Boris Worm, that wherever you go where the cod was, they've gone down the drain. This isn't just something in one little place. It's everywhere. This is Willy Christensen and Daniel Pauly's now famous map. Red is good. That means lots of fish that we love to eat. Pale blue is bad. That means almost no fish that we love to eat. That's the way it was in 1900, and that's the way it is today. And the governments are arguing about whether or not we should restrict our fishing policies in this situation, and it speaks very clearly for itself. The other thing we do in fishing when we don't do it with long lines is we drag things, the weight of locomotives, across the bottom, and we turn forests into parking lots. And most of the continental shelves of the world look like this picture. The area of seafloor, which has been converted into plains like this, rivals the area of all the forests ever cut down on land by humanity in the entire history of humanity, and we've done it in the last 100-150 years. And so that's the way it used to be. This is Daniel Pauly's picture. There used to be a lot of big stuff, sea monsters and good tasty fish, and forests on the seafloor, and now we have sardines, anchovies, and mud. Coastal seas and estuaries. This is an amazing study by Heike Lutz and a whole bunch of people going through tons of historical records, the kind of qualitative stuff all those ecologists hate. But basically what this shows is that take any group of organisms that we value, you know, the big marine mammals, the birds, the fish we care for, marine reptiles, the shellfish on the bottom that we like to eat, the seagrass, the submerged aquatic vegetation, all the things that creates the habitat, and we nuked them. And you can look at it in terms of functional groups, and you get a very similar story. This is Julia Baum's data. She's here on the decline of sharks in coastal seas and over the shelf in the northwest Atlantic, and this is just in the last 40 or 50 years. Think about how much more the decline would have been, this is only the last 25 years, and huge declines. This is a particularly interesting story because we know a lot about what those sharks eat. And so here you see the decreases in terms of abundance of all the big sharks. Here you see the increases in the smaller sharks and rays that the big sharks used to eat. So these are gone. These are now abundant. And of course, these things eat other stuff. The cow-nosed ray eats scallops and other shellfish. And so we have this incredible trophic cascade where hammerhead sharks that used to eat these things, which now number in the millions, which eat these, and the commercial scallop fishery that had existed for 100 years is gone. The cow-nosed rays are super abundant, and the hammerhead sharks have gone down the drain. The scale of this is just astounding. Just in the Chesapeake Bay, there are more than 40 million cow-nosed rays that migrate through the area. Each one of them eats a whole hell of a lot of shellfish. They're in the bay for 100 days. They eat this astounding amount of shellfish, which is 2,500 times greater than the commercial harvest. It's not a surprise that this has all disappeared. Species invasions in estuaries have gone through the roof. And this is the most, this is the poster child of invasions. This is the alga caulerpa that was introduced into the northwest Mediterranean from the Monaco Aquarium. It was bred to be cool temperature tolerant so people could have it growing as a pretty plant in their aquaria. If you remember the movie The Little Shop of Horrors and the plant growing throughout the shop, or if you think about kudzu vine in the south, this is the kudzu of the Mediterranean. It is carpeting the entire sort of shelf area of the northwestern Mediterranean. Nothing eats it. It's transforming bottom communities that had between 500 and 1,000 species of algae and invertebrates into monocultures of caulerpa and a few other things. And then the degradation of water quality in coastal seas. This is something we can actually study from cores and geochemistry, so there's very hard data to support this. And so what you see is that all the things we valued in estuaries were the breadbasket, as it were, of humanity in the coastal zone. It's where all great civilizations arose. We've pretty much removed everything we valued in them, and we've created all this toxic stuff in them instead. And the result is the formation of more than 150 major dead zones around the world in coastal seas. Dead zones aren't dead. They're Precambrian, late Precambrian communities of microbes and jellyfish. And the only commercial harvest that can be sustained in dead zones is jellyfish. It's a major fishery, and they ship them to Taiwan. The hyperproduction in a dead zone is way beyond the ability of grazing animals to consume the phytoplankton, so they just die and rot. The breakdown of these microbes sucks up all the oxygen in the system, and so the water is anoxic all the way down from the very shallow surface area, and that's something to keep in mind. And look at the scale of this. So, I mean, this is a dead zone writ large, as it were. This is a toxic algal bloom. The Mississippi Delta is here. The Texas-Mexico border is here. This is a single population explosion. That's a pretty large-scale event. It kills fish. It's caused by dinoflagellates. And that picture I showed you in the beginning of the toxic bloom coming ashore is this same species, Karenia brevis. These things used to happen in the past. Ponce de Leon described a red tide in Florida, but they were relatively uncommon events. Now you can set your watches by them. Okay. And then Fisteria, this disgusting things where fish come to the surface, spill out their guts, drift ashore, and make beaches really stink, is caused by another one of these really beautiful dinoflagellates. Dinoflagellates will definitely rule the world, and they are very biodiverse. So it's not at all clear that anything I'm talking about is going to result in a decrease in the number of species on the planet. They're just going to be things we don't like. The open ocean, how could we possibly make a dent in the open ocean, the unlimited bounty of the open ocean? Well, and you know, you put on your sailor suit, you go out and you catch a lot of stuff and you kill it and you hang it up and you have somebody take a picture of you and you know, your manhood grows. So this is Myers and Worm's famous picture, data from their paper on 90% of all the big fish are gone in the open ocean. This is incredibly controversial. This is the paper every fisheries biologist in the world practically loves to hate. There may be some problems with the data. It may not be 90% of all the big fish are gone. It may be 70% of all the big fish are gone. The data for this study came from that well-known environmental organization, the Japanese longline fishing industry, so I don't think it was the World Wildlife Fund. And this is the map of it. Red, again, is good, and pale blue is bad. There used to be a lot of big fish in the global ocean. There aren't any more. End of discussion. Okay, and then they did it again, Ward and Myers, looking at the tropical Pacific, and you can see that all the big stuff has decreased in biomass dramatically. The small stuff hasn't been as affected. And just like that trophic cascade involving the cow nose ray, there's some suggestion that there's a dramatic increase in some smaller species in this part of the ocean as well. And if you sort of make a biomass pyramid, this is, you know, and so we're looking at size here, and this got cut off, but this is number of fish caught per 1,000 hooks. So it used to be more than 100 fish per 1,000 hooks were caught, and now it's down around 25 or something, and they used to be really big, and now they're really small. And it's just, that's the way it is everywhere you go. Okay, this is, let's move to the Caribbean. You know, when Columbus discovered America. This is Lauren McClenahan's data on sea turtles. This is the result of a couple of years in archives in Europe and North America. And, you know, reading things like we went to this place and we killed 500 turtles that we brought back to eat. And, oh, yes, there were eggs there. So we took them, too. And you take that and you put it together. And we know from some hunting data in Jamaica, the Cayman Islands site, we actually know that they came back with 13,000 turtles a year for 100 years, and you can play games with that. And just like the back of the envelope calculations for the biomass of mammoths in the past, you can do something for the abundance of turtles. And so these big circles represent nesting beaches where there were 6 million adult half-ton animals coming ashore to nest or hanging around outside doing their thing. And the small circles are a guess of what it would be for the lesser beaches. And you get a number like 90 million adults, somewhere between 50 and 150 million. Does it really matter? Regardless of that range, it's more biomass than all the bison in North America before the arrival of the horse and the rifle, and it's more biomass than the animals, the mammals in Africa, period. It's a big number. That's a lot of turtles. They ate something called turtle grass. I did my thesis on the ecology of turtle grass communities in the Caribbean, and I never saw a green turtle in a turtle grass bed in the 4 years that I spent doing that. The way it is now is those yellow circles represent places where there's more than 100, not 6 million, 100 nesting animals, and the total population is well under 30,000. This is the geography of extinction of the Caribbean monk seal. The estimate from hunting data is something on the order of 250,000 to 500,000 individuals. And if they were alive today, all the fish in the Caribbean wouldn't feed them. That's how far the fish biomass has declined. These data come from, it's a meta-analysis, so take it with tons of salt, but of the decline in coral cover, of the decline in the sea urchin diadema that was the predominant lawnmower in the Caribbean, the consequent increase in the abundance of seaweeds on the seafloor, and the decline in the abundance of fish. These numbers are really probably representative of what pristine abundances used to be. But this number, for, and I'm sorry this is cut off, this is about 1975 to the present, and this number is obviously absurdly low, as you'll see in a minute, because, you know, there used to be fish up there. This is the result of a study done by Mara Newman and Gustavo Paredes, the person who had the thing before. And what they did was they went to Jamaica, the Florida Keys, Belize, Cozumel, and Cuba, and they looked at places that were marine reserves. That's what the arrows are, and those that weren't. Here's Jamaica over here. And you can see in 5 meters and 15 meters that the biomass ranges from, you know, 8 or 10 grams per meter square up to 500 grams per meter square, an enormous range in variability, and that high biomass is associated with protection. Surprise, surprise. Now, this number is 5 tons per hectare of fish, and keep that in mind because I'm going to show you something else with the same number. Taking their data and taking the work that Lauren did, looking at the old U.S. Fish Commission report of what were the common species on coral reefs in Florida in 1880, and then asked, well, how many of those were still common in the 1950s? Well, 75% of them were still common in the 1950s. Today, only 30% of them are common. And what's really extraordinary is 4 of those species that were the common important fishery species in Florida in 1880 are now listed as critically endangered or endangered, including the Nassau grouper. I mean, for someone as old as I am to think of what used to be almost a trash fish as being listed as endangered because it used to be, you know, one of the most common things to eat gives you a measure of the degree of this change. This is this really cool set of photographs that Lauren found of people who come back and show their trophies at the same dock over 50 years. So that's typical of the 1950s. That's typical of the trophies in the 1970s. And that's typical of the trophies today. They still pay an awful lot of money to catch those things. And you know, and so you can see that, you can turn that into data, right? I mean, they were big fish, and these are the 10 largest fish caught, you know, by the swollen egos at the end of the day, and it just goes down to the bottom, and don't worry about the legal part. And in the beginning, well, it wasn't the beginning, of course, but in the 1950s, a huge amount of what they were catching were those big groupers. In the 1970s, they're planktonic, pelagics, and today they're small snappers. So this is fishing down the food web in a sort of very dramatic way, and it's all there in sports fishing data. And then this is really interesting. This is the Goliath grouper. Okay, so this is a composite record. They would have been way up there, but even just taking it from the middle of the last century to the present, these are fisheries biology data, and notice the abundance has doubled, right? So the state of Florida wants to reopen the Goliath grouper fishery because it's obviously doing so well, right? There's a similar story for hawksbill turtles. Okay, sponges. You know, an extremely valuable commodity in Florida until they all died of disease, probably in relation to the way they were fished. Here's the decline in Caribbean coral again, and I put it in there again just to make the point that the causes of coral decline are really diverse. Acropora cervicornis, the staghorn coral, and palmata, the elkhorn coral, were the most abundant corals in shallow water. The rock of the island of Barbados is made of the skeletons of these things. These are geologically important organisms. 90% of them have disappeared since the 1970s, primarily due to disease, and work by John Pandolfi and work by Rich Aronson has shown pretty conclusively this never happened before. Here's an amazing time series picture from the Florida Keys, 1970. This is all Staghorn coral, and here's this big, massive coral beneath it. That's what it looks later, later, and today. You'd never know that that was a Staghorn coral forest, right? You would go out there like a nice, good little ecologist and lay your transect line and make a survey and say, look at this really cool reef community, which is dominated by Gorgonians and the odd massive coral, but this is what the community was like for thousands of years. Okay. And the reason they've all disappeared primarily is because of this disease that can wipe out, an area the size of your thumbnail per day. And even though these are the fastest growing corals in the world, this can grow up to 15 or 20 centimeters in a year. All of its yearly growth will disappear in less than a month. And then, of course, add coral bleaching to that. And just in 2005, there was this huge warm temperature anomaly in the Caribbean that probably wiped out something on the order of a quarter of the corals that were still alive, and that rivals the 1998 event in the Indian Ocean, an area the size of the continent of North America, where because of coral bleaching, 20% of all the corals in the Indian Ocean died in a single one-week bleaching event. Okay, and so the story of coral reefs is like this, right? It used to look like this. There are some of us in this room who are old enough to remember that. And now it looks like this. And it's the same in the Pacific. But this is the only little bit of hope. We went to the Central Pacific, to the Line Islands, to these four beautiful places. And one of them has nobody. One of them has 10 or 20 people. One of them has 2,500 people, and the other has 5,100 people. And a whole lot of people, I didn't do anything, I just watched them work. A whole lot of people, that's the way, right? A whole lot of people looked at the fishes, the bottom community, the corals, and the microbial community, which is something we're very proud of. Okay, in the island with no people, there's 5 tons of fish per hectare. Remember that number, which came from the south coast of Cuba? Castro protects the reefs on the south coast of Cuba. And there's a biomass of fish there comparable to the biomass of fish here, where all the neurotic fish that would be eaten by the sharks are hidden. And that's Kingman Reef, that's Palmyra. Those are those places in the Northern Line Islands. Kiritimati, Christmas Island, the worst place in the Northern Line Islands, has the same biomass of fish as Bonaire and Curacao, which have been protected for a long time. And all these places were 90% of coral reef research was done in these places that have no fish. Those are our models. Okay, but although biomass, obviously decreases with the presence of people, fish abundance increases. There's a lot more individuals. And with increasing disturbance, the coral dies, and the coral and algae, the pink stuff, which is necessary for coral larvae to settle, disappear, so you get this dramatic change in the benthic community. And if you sort of do an ordination analysis of all the data, all the benthic data and all the fish data, you see this striking transformation in total community composition, suggesting but obviously not proving that they're linked. What's really interesting is you also get this very strong response in the microbial community in terms of the numbers of microbes, the numbers of protists, the numbers of virus-like particles, all increasing with disturbance. And the numbers of potential pathogens are also increasing with disturbance. And a really important thing to understand about this is there's no agriculture, there's no fertilizer, and 5,100 people cannot make enough poop to nutrient load the coastal waters of a pinprick in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with a current roaring by. This is something that's happening for reasons very different from our usual concept. And then there's less coral individuals, there's more coral disease, and there's less coral recruitment, with this increasing numbers of people, so there's decreased resilience. And there's no pattern of diversity. Carl's decline, fishes increase in diversity, Carl's decline in diversity, viruses increase in diversity with increasing human disturbance. There is no clear signal of species diversity and human impacts in the ocean to my ability to see. So all these different things happen as a function of human disturbance. And they're all interrelated. And we're starting to understand how they're interrelated. This is the amazing experimental work of a guy named Davy Klein, who did experiments in Panama for a couple of years, and under highly controlled conditions, he had little bits of coral, and he added nutrients, which is what everybody has thought have been the threats to corals, and he added simple carbon compounds like sugars, and what he found was that there was a huge increase in mortality in the presence of the sugars, but not in the presence of the nutrients. And that's hardly surprising if disease is a major cause of coral death, because what do bacteria eat? They eat sugars, right? And so the sugars in the water are bacteria food, and they build up to huge concentrations. So here, for example, you have the microbial production rate over time in the presence of, well, in the controls, the phosphate, the nitrate, or glucose. Boom, huge population explosions. The microbes that normally live on the surface of the corals can no longer keep things under control. You get this explosive increase in the abundance of microbes, and the corals get sick and die. And then Jen Smith did an experiment while we were all in the Line Islands, where she took little bits of coral and little bits of algae and put them together with a millipore filter in between. And when you just had the coral in the tank, they didn't die. But when you had the coral and the algae next to it, even though they couldn't touch, they all died in these experiments. But if you put antibiotics in the water, they didn't die. So there's something going on with that organic material, which is going through the filter, but the bacteria can't go through the filter, but they explode in abundance and they kill the corals. So what's going on in a reef? You know, it's just mind-bogglingly difficult. I mean, first of all, you've got this coral, which is maybe one species of coral, but it's got hundreds of species of invertebrates on it, hundreds of species of fungi, thousands of species of microbes, thousands of virus taxa, whatever they are. So you have a zoo, you have a whole ecosystem in something this big as my fist, and, you know, it can die and make space for algae, which can also smother corals, or you can have pollution that makes algae grow, or you can have overfishing, which removes the grazers, which allows the algae to grow. The algae make detritus, and they leak organic matter. That increases the number of bacteria. So there are all these different routes, all leading to the same not-so-wonderful result. So, in summary, Nancy calls this the refining the obituary of nature, which is what I sometimes think 95% of conservation biology is, unfortunately. We are causing extreme habitat changes, which is causing reductions in entire suites of organisms to the point of ecological extinction. Who cares if they're extinct? They will be extinct. It's not worth trying to find out if they're extinct, because we'll never find most of them again. This elimination of all these things that we used to value is providing the opportunity for all sorts of new creatures on the block, which are going to increase in abundance whether we like them or not. The cow-nose ray is an example. All the seaweed on the reefs of the world is an example. All of those microbes that we don't like very much are examples. And, of course, these newly established communities are really hard to get rid of. It's the Humpty Dumpty effect, you know. It's really easy to break an egg, and it's very hard to put it together again. And there are experiments being done now, which are probably the most exciting and important ecology that's being done in conservation ecology, to see whether or not you can overcome these thresholds to actually restore ecosystems to something vaguely like what they used to be. But I can tell you it's not a particularly happy literature. Okay, so given all that, what are the projected long-term consequences of these changes for the environment and human well-being? And, you know, the Millennium Ecosystems Assessment is a wonderful thing. And I thought it was really cool that it had scenarios, but those scenarios are defined in terms of what we can imagine. And in my mind, that's what's wrong with those scenarios. Scientists are just really not good at sticking their necks out. It takes people like this to write books like Brave New World and 1984, right? And if you think about how 1984 was considered to be outrageous and how it's all true today, look at the White House, there's something to be gained from this. So at any rate, I think it's, don't you love that? A book to be read again and again and ponder before oblivion comes. Actually, the best, I don't know how many of you read The Time Machine, but if read it or reread it, it's wonderful because, you know, our hero advances forward in time and he goes to a time in the future where humans have evolved into two species, the Alloy and the Morlocks, and the Alloy are the effete former aristocrats who are basically farmed by the Morlocks, who are the working class living underground, and they eat the Alloy, you know, because people have eliminated all animals on Earth except for people, and so they have to breed people to eat them. And our hero escapes from the Morlocks in a very, very difficult situation and jumps in his machine and fast forwards and goes too far. And he gets to a time on the future Earth when the sun is bigger and there is nothing on the Earth but slime and a giant crab that almost devours him in his machine. And that, we're going there. Okay. So the global ocean, you know, there used to be a lot of big animals, but we know what happened to them. And there used to be a lot of three-dimensional structure, and that hung on long enough for people like me and Paul to see it. And this is where we're going. So we heard about mass extinctions, and I used to think, there was a wonderful meeting here 6 years ago on the future of evolution that was organized by Andy Knoll and Norman Myers, actually. And there was a lot of parallel in that meeting to the meeting we're having here. And I heard David and Doug at that meeting talk about the wisdom that we can derive from the fossil record, and I thought, you know, this is really interesting, but I don't think it has anything to do with what's going on now. I mean, we're going through something really terrible, but I don't see. But, you know, the Permian Triassic extinction, we're going there. I mean, I'm going to show you three scenarios. This is the one, this is the hopeful one. This is the best humanity can hope for. Now you just think about how likely it is that we will cap and reduce nutrient runoff and carbon emissions and stop overfishing within the next 2 to 3 decades. If we do that, the oceans will stay well mixed. There will still be oxygen in the deep sea. Dead zones will decrease. But we probably won't have any megafauna, but that'll be fine because, you know, mahi-mahi tastes good. And there'll be more mahi-mahi if you don't have big things to eat the mahi-mahi. And you know, we could have massive agriculture and we could live happily ever after. We wouldn't need fish. But if we fail to cap and significantly decrease carbon emissions, even if we stop overfishing and even if we control nutrient runoff, the oceans are going to become acidic as hell. And they're going to be vertically stratified because, you know, warmer water at the surface is harder to mix down to deeper, colder water. We're already measuring in the eastern Pacific a decline in overturn. We're already measuring a decline in upwelling rates. We're already measuring a decrease in nutrient flux to the surface. So, you know, the ocean could become not only acidic, but stratified like the Black Sea. And, you know, the Black Sea used to have, before the Russian agricultural revolution, used to have a prospering fishery in surface waters. But, you know, it was stratified and not a very good place for people in deeper water. So we'd have dominance of opportunistic species in the surface, as in the first scenario. We have the demise of calcified organisms, including corals, mollusks, and major groups of plankton like coccolithophores. Think about the fact that coccolithophores made the chalk of the White Cliffs of Dover. They're the most productive primary producers in temperate and warm, sort of low polar oceans, they will be replaced by something, undoubtedly a cyanobacteria or something, and that will be good, bad, or indifferent, who knows, but it's an uncontrolled experiment. There is lots of experimental data to show that coccolithophores just give up the ghost when the pH drops to levels it will arrive at. The ocean will arrive at that pH in 50 to 100 years. And there'll be anoxia below the thermocline, and it's starting to sound like the Permian. And then if we just don't do anything, which is highly likely, there will be extreme nutrient enrichment on top of all the other things that I said, and so we'll have dead zones surrounding the land masses of the world. Maybe the dead zones will move into the open ocean. The coastal waters will be too toxic for agriculture. You don't really want to eat something, an oyster that was raised in an environment that had dinoflagellate blooms. It would be kind of a gastronomic Russian roulette. Sometimes it's okay and sometimes it isn't. So that's where we're going, and we'll have escape from Malibu. So what do we have to do to head off this remarkably grim scenario, which I think you've got to agree. I mean, the amphibians may be disappearing, but if you look at those photographs that David showed yesterday of the Sierras, it's still beautiful, right? There are still forests. There are still lots of other animals. We're talking about a situation with no forest, no grass, no birds, no, you know. So these are the things we have to do. We have to stop fishing now. Period. I mean, we gave up a long time ago trying to live off of elk and moose and buffalo, right? We know what we did to the buffalo. So whether we like it or not, and most of my environmental friends hate this because they hate aquaculture, we got to go there. And Dan Jansen said this 20 years ago, right? I mean, there is, in his Gardenification of Nature essay, there is no alternative. To not do that is to hasten the extinction of all those things that are on their way. Dead zones, like the Chesapeake Bay, I mean, we could fix them. Think of all those lawns, think of all those golf courses, think of all the chicken shit, think of all the pig shit. Just around Chesapeake Bay, none of that stuff is taxed, and it all just runs off. The rise of slime is a huge threat to human health and to the production of marine resources. And it's getting more and more dangerous to eat anything that comes out of that water, and it's going to get more and more dangerous, and it's happening now. But we could fix it. And then finally, you know, and this is a real laugh, I mean, capping carbon emissions in 20 or 30 years? But if we don't, I mean, there's a guy down the hall, I never knew what he did. I mean, he's a chemist, and I don't talk to chemists. And then he came and he gave a lecture to our conservation course this summer about the standardization of the measurement of the pH of the surface ocean globally, which he's in charge of. And they've measured a 0.1 decrease in pH. And it's exactly what they're expecting from the increase in CO2. And you can plot the graph, and you know when you're going to get there. So, I mean, there it is. I mean, you be the judge. I think I'm about as optimistic as our evening speaker was last night. I mean, whereas I think for all of you thinking about conservation on the land, you see these as kinds of choices and situations in which it's really theoretically interesting to contemplate, you know, how diversity changes over distance and all this cool stuff. But when you change the rules to the point that there are no more forests, then you've sort of jacked the stakes up a whole level, and that's where we are in the oceans. Thank you.